Welcome, Helen. Thanks very much for talking with us.
I do.
Hello and welcome to Helen Minnis, Professor of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at the University of Glasgow. For many years, Helen, you've been working therapeutically and researching children who've been abused and neglected. And today we're going to be hearing about your focus on researching interventions, working with fostered and adopted children, and also what your lived experience has been as a Black woman, a clinician, and a psychiatrist, how that's informed your work with children and families. So there's a best services trial. That's a randomized controlled trial of an infant mental health intervention for children aged 0 to 5 coming into foster care. Right. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so that is trialing what we're calling the New Orleans intervention model. And that is an amazing model, I think. I can say that now because we've collected all of the data and we don't know what the outcome is going to be. But I got interested in that. Honestly, it must have been 2004. I went and spent some time in New Orleans with Charlie Zina, Julie LaRue, and they had this intervention that they were using for all children coming into foster care under the age of 5. It was very linked in with the courts so that the court would kind of manage the system and really support the deadlines, and the whole purpose was to work with birth families. No one at that time was doing anything like that. So families where a judge had actually adjudicated that there had been abuse and neglect. But the purpose of the team, and this is what I absolutely loved about it, is that the whole purpose is to try and really give the family the best possible chance of changing enough to have the children back. And actually, there was some research using routine data in Louisiana, looking at the 4 years before and the 4 years after they started doing that, that suggested big reductions in maltreatment of not just children who went home to parents, but also subsequent siblings, whether or not the original child had been adopted or had gone home. But because it wasn't a randomized controlled trial, you can't be certain that that was due to the intervention. And that was really what gave us the springboard to say we want to do a trial of this.
So what were the major factors that you saw in New Orleans that really attracted you to adopting this in the UK?
But for me, what I love about the approach is that you have a specialist, multidisciplinary infant mental health team really focused on giving these families who've got into terrible difficulties the best possible chance of getting their children back. And what I loved when I went to New Orleans, and what I love about the work of the Gift and Lift team, which is our British versions, is that I think clinicians have really learned that pretty much every single family who's got into that really, really awful situation has been trying to do their very best. And that many of those families are not only willing to change, but can change. And of course, there are also families who are willing to change and who can't change enough. And that's terribly sad. But I just love the kind of value system that, you know, that the acceptance that families are trying their best, their very best. Let's work with that. That's what I love about it. And we'll see. I mean, we're comparing the Glasgow family team and the London family team, our British versions of the New Orleans intervention model, with social work. And my mum was a social worker, and I think she was a really good social worker. And I think good social work tends to do the thing. And so really what we're trying to do in the trial is to see whether an infant mental health model or a social work model is going to be the best approach. And we're just learning loads about, I suspect we're learning a lot about what's bad about both of those different approaches.
You said to me when we were, just before we started recording this interview, that there's a fundamental difference between the approach in New Orleans and the UK, that foster carers are not seen as long-term carers.
In Britain, yeah. And I mean, to be honest, if it doesn't work in the UK, my gut feeling is that that might be a really, really major reason why it doesn't work. And we don't know whether it'll work or not yet. But in New Orleans, in the United States, there was a piece of federal legislation. I think it was the late 90s. I think it was 1999 or something like that, there and thereabouts, called the Adoption and Safe Families Act. And it basically required that there was just a different approach to foster care. And really on the back of that, a lot of states in the United States started jointly registering foster carers as adopters. What that means is that a foster carer who takes on the care of a child really is saying, if this child can't go home, I'm committing to this child for life. But with the understanding that if the birth family is able to change, the child will go home. And that's such a different approach from the way we do it in the UK, because in the UK, the idea is that foster care is essentially a kind of holding situation until the child can either go back to the birth family or be adopted. So there's a change of placement inherently built into that. And what we found is that in the UK, some foster carers commit to the child for life anyway, but actually the system doesn't support that. So, you know, there's a whole issue about foster care commitment. And because we were aware of that, we've actually used a wonderful measure that was developed by Mary Dozier called the This Is My Baby or This Is My Child interview, depending on the age of the child. And it asks foster carers really about the degree to which they think their care of the child is likely to be contributing to the child's development. What do they see for the long-term outcome for the child, their role in it? And my colleague Fiona Turner has done some really interesting work looking at the links between foster care commitment and children's outcomes in terms of attachment disorder symptoms, in other words, their ability to really plug into intimate relationships and their mental health outcomes. We haven't looked at that by group, so we haven't looked at that, you know, according to whether you've gone to the infant mental health teams or the social workers, but we've just looked at the whole group and it's been fascinating.
And you've got another trial going on. One's not enough, is it, Helena? You've got at least three trials going on here, which we're gonna unpick and find out what's emerging. The second trial is called Partnership for Change, and you're co-producing an intervention for parents of children who have a social worker but are not in child protection with parents of children who do have a social worker. Yeah. Tell us about that.
Yeah. Oh, this has been so much fun. We're just at the co-production stage. We haven't started the trial yet. The trial is due just in October. So we're seeing that deadline rushing towards us. But it's been such exciting work because all the way through the Best Services trial, you know, families, social workers, clinicians were all saying to us, are we not getting in a bit late here? You know, are we not waiting till too many bad things have happened to families? Why don't we try and intervene more upstream before the child goes into child protection? And we've always said, yeah, great idea, but that's a different trial. And I think what's really been helpful to us, this trial is funded by an organisation called What Works in Children's Social Care. I think they're a fantastic organisation and they have really strongly encouraged co-production. I think the co-production element is one of the reasons we got the funding. And so we've got a scientific co-investigator called Sharon Graham, who is an expert by experience. So she's experienced some of the worst things about being a parent whose child's been in the care system. It's been she had very difficult experiences, but she's really been open about sharing. And she has been a fantastic scientific partner because she has got knowledge that I don't have. I'm very lucky not to have had my children involved with social work. And what Sharon has done is she's brought together two groups of parents. We're called Parent Collaborators, one in Glasgow and one in Bromley, South London. And they're working very hard with the gift and lift teams right at the moment as we speak. There's a most phenomenal amount of work going on to try and understand how to modify the two teams.
So the gift and lift teams are the teams that are adapting this New Orleans model that we've just
been. Well, I wouldn't say the gift and lift teams are adapting it. We're all adapting it with the parent collaboration. That's really important. So yes, the gift and lift teams are the new Orleans intervention model teams that we're trialling in Beth. And we've got two groups of parent collaborators, gift and lift, and you know, we're having these big development days every couple of months where we all meet, and in between there's lots of subgroups. And it's been fascinating work. What we're trying to do that's a little bit different from the way that Gift and Lift have worked so far, they've got these really well-evidenced interventions that are very relationship-focused, and we don't want to fix that because it isn't broke. We love that. That's what they do really well. But what we're trying to add is a poverty-aware approach. So have a much more kind of hands-on social work, welfare rights, support for housing, insecurity, etc. approach. And we're trying to introduce more of a focus on neurodevelopmental conditions. Because one of the things our research has shown over the last few years is that children who've experienced abuse and neglect are much more likely to also have problems like ADHD, autism, tic disorders, that kind of thing, that are actually heritable and run in families. So if the children have those problems, the parents may also have those problems. So we're trying to better understand how those children and parent problems might interact to make parenting difficult and to increase the struggles that the families are having. And it's been fascinating work.
Just to tell Helen, in knowing a bit more about what the parent who has had experience of her children and her family being involved with social services, what are her main problems that she's saying that she experienced?
She's an amazingly collaborative person, and you know, she is through the other side of being angry with social workers, because I think she realizes what an incredibly difficult job they have. But I think what I've really learned from Sharon, and it's not just a problem with social work, it's also a problem with CAMHS, and I'm a CAMHS clinician now, I've got to take this on the chin. We go into meetings with families and we have an agenda. So we are there, you know, if I'm a CAMHS clinician, I've got 50 minutes and I want to know presenting complaint, history, presenting complaint, family history. You know, I've got an agenda. What I really learned from Sharon is that we need to be setting the agenda with parents, because there are blooming obvious things that they will be able to see that we can't. And so she tells an incredibly moving story about, you know, and she has actually videoed this. So it's actually out there. She did we interviewed each other actually for an NSPCC conference recently about this, but there was a point when she was on the verge of suicide and there was a street worker who stopped and talked to her for an hour and a half in the middle of the night and just said, why are you in this place just now? What brought you to this place? And she said that just completely turned her life around. The fact that somebody was interested in her as a person. What was her journey? What was her story? How did it come to this? Mm-hmm. And I think what I really learned from Sharon, many things, I mean, there's so many things, but a really crucial thing is that every parent who's come to that awful situation of being in such a terrible situation that, you know, there are child protection concerns about your children. Do you know, they've had the most massive stresses. Stresses that, you know, if you've not come to that situation, you just can't imagine. It might be to do with your own early trauma, but it might be to do with the fact that you don't actually have enough money to feed your kids on a Friday because your money's run out, or that you've been sanctioned, you've got to go to a food bank and it's really shaving. There are so many pressures that families are experiencing that we just can't imagine. And I think what I've really learned, what Sharon has really taught me, is that somehow we need to create space for families in that situation to actually have a voice, be able to tell us, what can you fix right now that could help and that could bring my stress down just enough that I can actually be parenting my children the way I want to parent them.
It sounds like you've got a real sort of feeling for parents, that you feel quite passionately for them. Often what I hear from clinicians is perhaps their difficulty that they might have with parents about, you know, perhaps that they're not treating a child in quite the way that they would want them to. And so I think quite a lot of clinicians might take the side of the child, whereas what I think what you're doing is you're obviously thinking about children very much, but in the context of them having parents who can be helped best to parent them.
Yeah. Oh, I do feel passionately about it. And I feel that having that sort of having that passion for really understanding and being compassionate to parents is the exact opposite of not being child-centered. It's not that you're not being child-centered, because actually what you realize is that parents want the best for their children as well. And so if you can be compassionate and work alongside parents, then they are allies, and they can, even if for some parents they're in a situation where they are not able to give enough for their children, they're still allies, because they can still tell you a lot about their children. They can tell you a lot about how they got there. They can tell you about their child's journey. And so however awful the situation for the child is, I don't think we get to be judgmental. We need to stop being judgmental, because we haven't walked in that parent's shoes. And, you know, goodness knows if we had, we might be doing a worse job than they were. Yeah. You know? And so I think it's been a difficult message to get across sometimes, because I think sometimes people hear my passion for being compassionate with parents, they think that I'm pulling my wool over my eyes and not realizing that very occasionally, very, very occasionally, there's a parent who is actually sadistic. I've only come across that once in my career. I think it's extremely rare. But that for the vast majority of parents, they're just trying their best, and they can help a lot in helping us together to understand the child and support the child.
You're doing a randomised controlled trial of dyadic developmental psychotherapy that was originally developed by Dan Hughes. And I know there's been it's been a huge uptake, hasn't it, here in the UK? And it's one of the reasons why we featured him as a legacy interviewee on Mind in Mind. And so this trial is with children who've been adopted and fostered, isn't it?
That's right. Yes, they need to be either... To take part in the trial, we're recruiting families with children aged 5 to 12 who are either adopted or in permanent foster placements. And that's because this really was based on a lot of discussions with Dan himself and also other experts in the UK, people like Ben Gurney-Smith, Kim Golding, really to settle on who do we want to do this first randomised controlled trial of DDP with. And we settled on this group because the whole ethos of DDP is to really try and kind of hand over the reins to families, you know, really get them in the driving seat and help them feel confident in parenting children who've had early trauma. And so it's really important that those are the forever families, that they are the families that are committed to the children, because the last thing you want is to be doing that really challenging therapeutic work and for the child not to feel safe in that placement. So it's been a really fantastic kind of journey working with Dan and other colleagues on who are experts in DDP, because we've been working together to try and develop this trial for well over a decade, and Dan has always been completely open to research. And he said something really inspiring once we got the funding, we're ready to start. He said, you know what, if we were to find out that DDP wasn't a cost-effective intervention, then what we would do is we'd get right down to understanding how to modify it and make it better. As far as I'm concerned, that's the best attitude, and it means that whatever we find in the study is going to be helpful.
Quite a lot of people might not know what DDP is. Perhaps you could explain.
So DDP is quite
what it involves.
Yeah, it's quite an intensive.
Parents and children together, isn't it?
It's quite an intensive family-based therapy. The way we're delivering in the trial is across approximately 3 to 6 months of weekly work that starts with work to parents only. And then once the child begins to be involved, there's still always communication with the parents before the child comes into the room. And that's basically so that parents can really get a good understanding of how the child's current behaviour might be related to their past experiences. You're trying to help the parents understand the roots of the child's behaviour, simultaneously trying to prove the way the parents and the child relate together, which is why it's called dyadic, because it's really focusing on the pairs in the room. So how is mum and the child relating? How is dad and the child relating? How is therapist and mum relating? How is the therapist and the child? It's really complex. And to see it done well is you know, watching someone conduct an orchestra. It's very, very skilled work. And really the aim is to help the child kind of plug into the parents as parents, because really abused and neglected children often don't quite understand what a parent is for. And so DDP is very different from many of the other treatments that are available. Many psychotherapies that are used for children in the care system are individual psychotherapies, you know, where the child comes into the room separately from the parents. A lot of clinicians don't bring the child into the room at all. They'll simply do work with parents alone or with foster carers or adoptive parents alone. And then in other parts of the country, this group of families really don't get much access to therapeutic services and tend to be kind of held by social work.
So what's emerging from that study so far, Helen?
The phase one findings have been absolutely fascinating. And this is before we even started randomising. What we found is that the services for adoptive foster families of this age group of children across the UK is a patchwork. It's a postcode lottery. What you get is going to depend on where you are. And my colleague, Verity Westgate, who's the trial manager for the English sites, she's done some fantastic work mapping services in the feasibility sites. So at the moment, we're involving an NHS site in Scotland. We're involving a third sector site around Milton Keynes. And we're involving a site in Oxfordshire where DDP is delivered through social care. So that in itself tells you DDP is delivered in all of these different contexts, which is really challenging. So that's kind of the background in which we're trying to do this trial. And I think it's going to be quite, whatever we find about DDP, that in itself is going to be really important for policy moving forward. Whatever we do in future, we've got to make services for this group of families more coherent, because there's such a patchwork at the moment.
What do you think the main predictors are of successful adoptions?
Wow, what a big question. So I am basing this not on research. I'm basing this on my clinical experience and my reading of lots of research. So I don't want people to hang their hats on this. For me, I think there are two really big important things. One is the support that the adoptive family gets. And there was some work that was done in Bath and Wiltshire many years ago where they used an approach that every single adoptive family who had a child placed with them for the first time got a really intensive sort of therapeutically supportive first meeting. And then it was decided where they would go thereafter. About a third of the families didn't need anything else. About a third of the families needed a bit of work, and about a third of the families needed a lot of work. Do you know, they didn't have a single adoption breakdown in about 10 years.
It's quite incredible, that, isn't
it? It's incredible. So I think for me, a recognition that adoptive families need the potential for support is crucial. Other really important factor, and this is a really important message for adoptive families, is that it depends a lot on what the child brings to the family. And some children come into adoptive families without any mental health problems. And we don't really know why some children just are resilient in terms of their mental health, but some are. Probably about a third of adopted children, it just all fits and everything goes fine. And I really do not believe that's to do with the parenting that they've been offered, actually, because in my experience, I've met hundreds of adoptive families, and my goodness, they are dedicated to their children. And as a group, they are super parents, you know. So there's that. But our previous research has shown very clearly that children who come into the care system are much, much more likely to have these heritable problems, things like ADHD, autism, tic disorders. And, you know, if children have kind of good enough parenting in the first few years of life, most of those children are absolutely fine. And some of them are still fine in adoptive families. Things, you know, they're just lucky that their type of ADHD or autism doesn't create huge problems for parents. But some of those children, especially if they then on top of that developed problems with signalling their needs, then those children can be extremely difficult for parents to give their love to, because the children are not ready to accept it, you know. And it's such a sad thing when you see that, especially because it is fixable. So if you've got a child who, for example, say you've got a young child with ADHD, who because of ADHD is more prone to flying off the handle, having temper tantrums. You know, if there wasn't anything else going on, most families would just get to know that child and be able to deal with it. If that child doesn't understand what parents are for, so if that child also doesn't realise that those parents are there to help, so they won't go for help when things are difficult. They won't tell the parents that they've skinned their knee or that they've got a tummy ache. And so unless you're somehow psychic, and none of us are, then you won't realise that that child is getting more and more stressed, because those children, because of their early trauma, just may not actually relate those feelings to their face. And then suddenly, bam, the child is unpredictably flying off the handle. You know, that would be hard for any parent. And, you know, we did a study a few years ago where we were doing really comprehensive assessments of children this age group, primary school age children, who had mental health problems and were in adoptive families. And sometimes our research assistants had migraines at the end of the morning, because the level of problems that these children had were really hard to deal with and would have been hard for any parent. And unfortunately, I think what often happens with these otherwise really well-functioning parents is that by the time they come to services, they're kind of like this. You know, any of us would be, you know, you might not have had your breakfast, you know, you might be still in your pajamas, you're just desperate, you're like this. And what we do in our judgmental pathway is we say, oh, that must be your problem. You must have caused this. You know what? I think 99.9 times out of 100, that is not the case. This family has a really, really challenging parenting task because they've got a wee person with problems who doesn't know to go for help.
Yeah.
So I think understanding that the kind of support needed by adoptive families, permanent foster families, is needs to include an understanding that children may well have real kind of CAMHS workload type of problems, and we need to be looking for those, as well as trauma-related problems. If we could get that right, we could be really preventing a lot of adoption breakdowns.
So given your research, Helen, in this area, what changes would you like to see implemented in regard to what we do with maltreated children who come into the care system?
So if I could wave a magic wand, there would be an assumption that every substitute family, whether they're a foster family, a kinship family, you know, extended family, or an adoptive family, are going to require additional support. So an assumption that a child who has had to come into the care system is likely to have additional needs. So we need to stop treating these families as if love is going to be enough, because it usually isn't. There needs to be at the very least, sometimes it's only a very light touch that's needed, but at the very least, I think families need to be supported to understand this thing that often children who've been abused and neglected don't quite get, how to ask to have their needs met in an ordinary way. So,
what I was going to say, I mean, I, you know, I, it doesn't sound like, you know, you're being extravagant at all, that you're asking for something that's really an obvious thing to do, I think, as a psychotherapist, and seeing, you know, having treated foster and adopted children. And it's not that we haven't known this for an awful long time, is it? And
well, yet, I think
we keep coming back to this problem that yeah. children coming into the care system aren't getting the support they need, and foster carers and adoptive parents aren't getting the support that they need as well.
Yeah, I think there are two problems with, because we kind of know that they need support, but I think there are two problems with the kind of support that's needed. So the first one, I think, is that problems like reactive attachment disorder and disinhibited social engagement disorder, if you want to use the disorder terms, are difficult to spot as problems. So reactive attachment disorder is just essentially where children really don't signal their needs. They don't seek comfort, they don't accept comfort, or they do it in a very minimal way that you could miss it. You know, they might just go, oh. And, you know, if you happen to blink, you would have missed that child is saying, "Mom, I've got a stomachache." And because we are primed as adults to, you know, our brains light up when a baby cries. If a baby doesn't cry, our brains don't light up. So we're not primed to notice that. And then disinhibited social engagement disorder, which is the other trauma-related problem that children get if they've been abused or neglected, some children get when they've been abused or neglected, is in some ways even more tricky, because children seem loving until you realise that they're just as loving with the postman as they are with the carer. So they don't understand intimacy. Virtually all children who are in the care system have some problems with signalling their needs, even if they don't quite meet these diagnostic criteria. So it's really difficult, because these are invisible problems. They're problems that we're primed not to notice. And then the second really big problem, I think, in clinical services is an assumption that children's problems are entirely trauma-related. And what our research has shown, as I've said a couple of times earlier today, is that actually these children are even more at risk of having non-trauma-related problems. So ADHD, tic disorders, intellectual disabilities, autism. The rates of these things are higher in this population. And I suspect, we don't know this, I suspect that may be because they run in families. And if you're a parent with a problem like this, and a child has a problem like this, and you're living in poverty, and you've got insecure housing, you've got a toxic mixture out of which maltreatment might arise. So I think one of the real mistakes we make is to forget that not only do these children need support, but they need ordinary, holistic CAMHS support. We at least need to be looking for all of these problems and not making assumptions about the roots of a child's behavioural difficulties, for example, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think what does make sense is this coming from someone who has had such a long interest in fostered and adopted children. What sparked your interest in this area?
Gosh, such an interesting question. I mean, I've often asked myself that, and I think it was quite accidental. My mother was a social worker, and she was a social worker back in the day when, you know, you got to have a caseload, and that was your caseload. And my mum was really good at confidentiality, but, you know, sometimes she'd come home on a Friday night and she'd say, "Oh my God, Mrs. X's husband's drunk all the money before he got home, and I've had to do an emergency payment." And so I got a real insight from her into, I guess, the challenges of being a struggling family. And I actually remember, actually, at one point, she couldn't get anyone to drop a little boy in foster care to school. So we used to drop him to school on the way to school, and he would sit there in the car looking really kind of, you know, like this. And then after I studied medicine, all I wanted to do was travel. I didn't know why. I just wanted to go somewhere interesting that wasn't Britain. And so I spent quite a few years kind of training myself up to have enough obstetrics, casualty experience and things to go to the low-income country. And I just got whatever job was available, and I got a job in an orphanage in Guatemala. I ended up, this is before I did any mental health training at all, but I ended up in an orphanage as the orphanage doctor and also essentially the GP for the surrounding villages. And because I wanted to train in psychiatry, I'd gone to speak to Eric Taylor. And Professor Eric Taylor has been a real mentor to me. What an amazing clinical academic. And he's most known for his work on ADHD, but I basically asked for a meeting with him because I wanted to go into psychiatry, wanted to go to the Maudsley, which is very research focused. He said, oh, I'm on the panel for the new ICD-10, as it was back then. We're now on ICD-11. That's the International Classification of Diseases, that the World Health Organization classification. And they were developing the new diagnostic criteria for reactive attachment disorder, what's now known as reactive attachment disorder. They literally sent me a photocopy of these. They said, I think that might be an interesting thing to think about when you're there. And I literally landed up in this orphanage in Guatemala, and immediately, as a stranger, I was just covered in children. So these little children under five, I just had children all over me, and I literally couldn't walk forward until I picked them off. And I was madly reading, trying to get myself through John Bowlby's amazing trilogy, Attachment, Separation, and Loss. And it wasn't until I did my first home visits in the local villages as a local GP that I realised that was really abnormal, because these families were living in absolute poverty. Like, they were much, much materially worse off than the children in the orphanage. Didn't have three meals a day. They didn't have chlorinated water, etc. But I would walk into these very, very materially poor families, and the children would hide behind their mother's skirts, just like John Bowlby said they would. They had strange anxiety. And you would see beautiful parent interaction. You'd see like a young dad, you know, talking to his infant and just doing what is done all over the world. These kids were getting great care, even though their families were really poor. And then in the orphanage, kids were getting a rotating stream of, worthy volunteers who they couldn't form attachments with. So yeah, that was where it all started for me. And I just thought, wow, this is so interesting. I want to understand it more, and I've been trying to understand it the rest of my career.
And I'm wondering how your lived experiences as a Black woman and clinician have informed your research.
That's such an interesting question. I'm really glad you asked it. So I think I'm only realising now the extent to which it's informed my experience, because I was when I was a wee trainee in psychiatry, myself and my colleague Laddie Smith, Shubha Laddie Smith, who's a very prominent general adult psychiatrist, you know her work. We were the first two Black female psychiatry trainees at the Maudsley, and there was a trainee called Kwame McKenzie, he's now in Canada, who was the first Black trainee, and he'd been in the cohort above us. He took me and Laddie aside and he said, can I just give you a bit of advice? Become a psychiatrist before you become a Black psychiatrist. I'm so glad he did, because it meant that I then could focus my career on what I'm really interested in, which is families. But I think as a Black woman working in largely white spaces, you unconsciously experience that sense of being other. And W. E. Du Bois, fantastic American philosopher, from the 19th century, he described this thing of double consciousness, which is where if you're Black in white spaces, you have to think about how you're perceived as well as how the person you're talking to perceives you. And I've become very aware since I became a professor, but a lot of people I'm talking to think, you don't look like a professor. And I'm thinking, yes, this is what a professor looks like, this is what scientists look like. So there's that. And I think that gives you skills in recognizing when other people in the room are having an experience of being other. And I think it's made it much, much easier for me to really relate to families who are really struggling. And actually, I mean, a good example was in Guatemala. When I arrived, I had no idea what an incredibly racist society that was. And it really was white at the top, Ladino, which were the kind of white Guatemalans, indigenous somewhere way below, and then Black down in the basement. So I arrived as a Black doctor And there had been a white Swedish volunteer with no medical training running the clinic before me, using a book called Where There Is No Doctor. She'd done a blooming good job considering she had no training. But I came in, and the local Indigenous communities who'd experienced terrible oppression, but had lived in this society with this hierarchy, they just looked at me and thought, you're not a doctor. And I could just tell immediately I had absolutely no belief in my medical skills. But of course I was a doctor. And so within literally about a fortnight, I'd actually cured a couple of pneumonias. I'd got some people started on medication for their anemia. I'd started some treatment for malaria. And folk were like, oh, actually she knows what she's doing. But they didn't have that fear of me as a big, scary person. And so bizarrely, after about 3 months, oh my goodness, I was in that community. I was really in that community. And even the local witch doctor's wife, we became buddies, even though he saw me as a business rival because I wasn't charging and he was. You know, and so there was a kind of pulling in that the Swedish volunteer could never have had because she was seen as this big, scary. So I think that's been a wonderful side effect of being a Black psychiatrist, actually.
Yeah, it's very moving, Helen. And I'd imagine that families who you work with here in the UK as well pick up that sort of willingness in you to actually be relatable and to really try and understand what's going on for them.
I'm so glad you asked that question, because it's something that it's just in recent years I've been asked to talk about race and psychiatry, or just racism in general. And I've always avoided it because of Kwame McKenzie's advice. And then my daughter Ellie said, I'd been asked to do this lecture about racism. And she said, look, Mum, you're a senior now. You just got to take it on the shoulder. Yeah. But it's been really fascinating, because what I've learned is that although clearly racism is a toxic, horrible thing, and it's had much more negative effects, far, far greater negative effects on many people that I know that I haven't experienced, because I grew up in Scotland where I didn't have low expectations of me. I think mainly because back in the 1970s, there were very few Black people, and they were nearly all doctors and PhD students. So the kind of the Scottish people were just like, you must be one of those brainy Black people, which was not the experience of Black people in most parts of the world. And I think that was very important for me. I didn't grow up with low expectations. But of course, I've experienced racism. I've experienced negative sides. For me, actually, as a scientist, I realise it's been incredibly positive. It's built skills in me that I wouldn't have had. And I think it's allowed me to do these complex trials, because you've got to work with such a range of people. And my daughter Ellie, she's a management consultant actually in the States at the moment. And she's quite funny. She says she's so aware of this, I guess, this double consciousness. It's so much more talked about in the States. And she says, I am learning to speak CEO.
You're learning to speak CEO?
CEO, yeah. She's learning to, it's like learning to speak Swahili or, you know, or Spanish. She's learning to speak chief executive. And I think being aware that that's a language that she can learn as a young Black woman is a huge advantage, actually, to realise that this is actually, might be difficult being in this very, very white space that she's in some ways, but actually she's developing skills.
Well, I think the adopted and foster world are very, very lucky to have all your skills, Helen.
That's really nice to say
that you're doing, hopefully is going to make a really, really positive difference to children's outcomes.
I hope so. It's always scary doing trials, because one of the reasons we do randomised controlled trials is because psychological interventions can be harmful. Yes. And you always worry a little bit, you know, are we trialling something that ends up having harms? But I think because we've got so much qualitative work going on, and we've got specific committees, independent committees oversee everything, I think that's unlikely. Obviously, I wouldn't be doing it if I thought it was likely. But we've got to be open to the fact that, you know, we hope that these interventions are beneficial. But if they aren't, then we will learn a lot about what to do better next time, I think.
Well, we'll come back to you when the trials are in.
Oh, please do.
And you've done your evaluation. It'd be great to get an update. Good luck with the rest of it.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Anne. Thanks for your time.